This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Indonesia's transportation ministry says Sriwijaya Air lost contact with one of its passenger planes shortly after takeoff from Jakarta on Saturday. Flight SJ-182 was bound for the island of Borneo. More than 50 people were on board the plane, according to officials. Flight Radar 24, the flight tracking service, said the Boeing 737 lost more than 10,000 feet of altitude in less than 1 minute, about 4 minutes after departure from Jakarta. The missing plane is currently under investigation and under coordination with the National Search and Rescue Agency and the National Transportation Safety Committee, a government spokesman said. 10 babies died Saturday in a maternity ward fire in western India. 7 babies were, however, rescued from the blaze at the Bhandara District Hospital in the state of Maharashtra. Agence France-Presse reports that the age range of the dead children was between a few days and 3 months old. Prime Minister Narendra Modi posted on Twitter that the incident is a heart-wrenching tragedy. Foreign companies will not be allowed to test COVID-19 vaccines on the Iranian people, President Hassan Rouhani said on Saturday, a day after Iran's supreme leader banned vaccine imports from the United States and Britain. Rouhani said in televised remarks, quote, foreign companies wanted to give us vaccines so they would be tested on the Iranian people, but the health ministry prevented it. He did not name the companies or give further details. And buildings shook briefly in Taipei on Saturday as a deep 5.7 magnitude earthquake struck off the northeastern coast of Taiwan, but there were no reports of damage. This is VOA News, and here are some of the headlines involving the global coronavirus crisis. Chinese authorities halted public transport in a provincial capital near Beijing on Saturday in an effort to stamp out a new cluster of coronavirus infections. She's a capital of Hubei province, which surrounds Beijing, suspended service on the city's subway, then extended the ban to all public transport, including taxis. The province entered a wartime mode this week to battle the infections. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said on Saturday the nation would continue to export medicines, including vaccines, as companies have ramped up production. The country with the highest number of infections in the world is India, coming after the United States, and it's developing 2 indigenous COVID-19 vaccines. Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine will arrive in France on Monday, the French Prime Minister said, as the country steps up its vaccination drive following a sluggish start. And in the United States, President-elect Joe Biden may speed up distribution of COVID-19 vaccines to U.S. states, a spokesman is saying, in an effort to jumpstart the slow rollout of inoculations that have made little impact on the pandemic 1 week into the new year. Such a move by Biden when he takes office on January 20th would be a departure from a Trump administration strategy to stockpile enough doses to ensure that required second doses of the vaccine are available. And in Southern California, that state is so overwhelmed with coronavirus cases that patients are backed up trying to get into hospitals, and corpses are getting stuck in another logjam once they leave. Google has suspended the social network Parlay because it has not removed what the company calls egregious content. Parlay calls itself an unbiased free speech social network. It's popular with people banned from Twitter. U.S. President Donald Trump has been banned permanently from Twitter following his supporters ransacking the U.S. Capitol in a siege in which several people died. Google says Parlay has not removed posts which could incite violence. Apple has also warned Parlay it will remove it from its app store if it doesn't temper its content. On Parlay, the app's chief executive said, quote, "We won't cave to politically motivated companies and those authoritarians who hate free speech." Parlay was launched in 2018 and became popular among Trump supporters and other conservatives, including Fox News host Sean Hannity and Republican Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Conservatives have frequently criticized Twitter and Facebook for censoring their speech. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
At a turning point of voting for the leaders of this country, and so they need a lot of information in order to make informed decisions, and the third vehicle for this information is the media. So the media must play a very central role in this by making sure that the journalists keep safe as they do this work.
The Ugandan Inspector General of Police comes under sharp criticisms for saying he will not apologize for police attacking journalists.
We will definitely be looking at all human rights violations that are happening in the context of elections, before elections, during elections, and after elections, and we will be pronouncing ourselves to what should be done as a result of the human rights violations that we have observed.
Amnesty International says it is monitoring issues of human rights violations in Uganda.
If the UPND are making inquiries on the same, they are participating like any other ordinary citizens who are interested to ensure that accountability becomes a hallmark of government public expenditure, and not that the UPND are instigating.
And a parliamentarian demands an independent inquiry into missing public funds at the Zambian Health Ministry. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The executive director of the Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists says a pronouncement by the Inspector General of Police opens the way for police officers to attack reporters in the run-up to the elections. Robert Sempala says journalists no longer feel safe carrying out their duties to report the news because of the stance of the chief of police. His remarks come after Martin Ochola, the Inspector General of Police, says the police have been beating journalists to restrain them from going where there is danger. His remark is being condemned by human rights and civil society groups. They are saying his statement is dangerous and an affront to the rule of law. Robert Sempala, the executive director, Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists, tells me that his organization is working with other groups to determine if there is a legal path to take against the chief of police.
Well, this is one of the most unfortunate statements to come from a head of a security force, most of the police. For long, we have thought that he would be the last resort for us to run to in terms of trying to secure the lives and property of journalists, the line of duty. But his pronouncement today has just dealt the last blow that there is no hope. And we only can now run to court as the only last resort. But everybody who has been following the trend of events in Uganda will tell you that it is not indeed the journalists that have targeted the police. The journalists have always been on the side of the police for protection, only the police to turn against them. So his pronouncements are really very unfortunate. They are coming in at a very critical time when we are in the peak of the elections, where we need journalists to be protected in order to do their work, and this anti-detection, where the Electoral Commission mandated the media to be a main campaign platform, but now only when journalists are beating them, there is no remorse on the part of the police leadership. It's extremely unfortunate.
Some people are calling for his removal on President Museveni to fire him. Others are saying it will not happen since he appears to be doing the bidding of the government, or for that matter, the president. What is your organization's stance on this?
We are talking amongst ourselves as media development organizations. We are having conversations with the editors, and we want to spread this conversation to many other actors to see what can action we can take in response to these very unfortunate pronouncements. A removal of the IGP would be a very welcome gesture. But we certainly know that is not likely to happen within the shortest spell of time when we head to elections, because the appointing authority has also severally, who is the president, of course, has severally said the media is not in his favor, the media works for the opposition and works for other forces that are foreign in nature. So we don't think that this will rub him the wrong way to attract and removal of the IGP. We don't think that is likely to happen very soon, but all we can say is that we'll hold the IGP personally liable for all the attacks that are going to happen onto journalists after now that he has come out publicly to say that there's no apology and that journalists will continue being beaten even when they're in the line of duty.
Now, Robert, some people cited the recent disturbance between Robert Mao, a presidential candidate, and the police. They say that this shows that the journalists will not be safe if the candidates themselves are not safe with the pronouncement of the Inspector General of Police. What do you say to that?
As a matter of fact, we have several documented incidents around journalists. And for the last 11 years, the police has been the leading perpetrator of violence against journalists. So it doesn't surprise me now when the IGP comes out to say that that is normal and the police will continue doing that. Actually, we should talk of us or about us as journalists, but many journalists have suffered the wrath of the men in uniform, the police and the army, and they have complained. Most of the cases not investigated, so it does not surprise us at all when finally the police comes out to own up the attacks that happened on journalists. That's very unfortunate because our legal framework has not sanctioned beating of innocent Ugandan. This bothers that everyone is innocent until proven guilty by a court of competent jurisdiction, but that to the police doesn't seem to make any little sense. They take the law into their hands. The timing, the nature of offense you've committed, the punishment, and then there's the jury. They also celebrate the actions that are taken, and they, at the end of the day, they have won against those they have beaten.
What is your message or advice to journalists in view of this pronouncement by the Inspector General of Police, particularly ahead of the upcoming general election?
We want to invite journalists to tread very cautiously, because now they know that they're deliberately targeted by the men that are supposed to guard them while doing their work. We also want to impose it upon the editors and the owners of media houses to come out strongly against this, because it's about the lives of journalists. Recently, the Editors Guild came out to say they were contemplating withdrawing journalists from the field because they were not any more sure of their safety. And this is something that we critically discuss and see if it is making any little sense to continue trading as though the situation is normal, having journalists go and put their lives on the line because they are covering presidential candidates. Certainly, that's an area that we need to critically discuss. But as for journalists, no story should be once they are alive, and I thought they should keep out of harm's way and make sure that they do not compromise or they don't act with rage or retaliation, but they keep a distance that makes them secure, but not also compromise on the information that they are able to relate to the wider public, because we are at a critical time when the country is at a turning point of voting for the leaders of this country. And so they need a lot of information in order to make informed decisions. And the sole vehicle for this information is the media. So the media must play a very central role in this by making sure that the journalists keep safe as they do this work.
Robert Sempala is the Executive Director, Human Rights Network for Uganda Journalists. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, Amnesty International says it is monitoring human rights violations in Uganda. Roland Ibole is a researcher for the rights group. He says the pronouncement of the Inspector General of Police about beating journalists is unfortunate and regrettable. This as the country's Electoral Commission prepares to administer the January 14 presidential and parliamentary polls. Amnesty International researcher Roland Ibole tells me that the statement by the Inspector General of Police endangers the lives of journalists across the country in the run-up to the elections.
I think it is very unfortunate that this is happening, considering that we have reports of at least three journalists that have been shot and two that are in critical condition as we speak. We have reports of 10 journalists who have been attacked by police because of covering opposition events, and this is since December 11, that is short of a month. And so by a chief of police to come and say that it is actually justifying government restriction or clampdown on freedom to right of expression and especially freedom of the press and freedom of the media. So this is something that we totally really condemn.
Some people are suggesting that the government appears to always accuse the media of citing or supporting the opposition. And sometimes the opposition, they said, uses the media to undermine the country's peace and stability. That is why the police sometimes would have to act and clashes happen. And that is why they said the Inspector General of Police was right. What do you say to that?
I don't think that this is very possible because these are journalists that are shot or they are attacked while covering opposition media events. And most of them are not even shot while covering an opposition leader addressing people. It is during some, a procession. And so the authorities are really clutching at straws or at a desperate position to really try and justify the attacks of many journalists. You must remember that, there have been reports from Human Rights Network of Journalists in Uganda that 100 cases of human rights violations against journalists, including police violence, especially when they are out covering political events, have been reported just in 2020. And I have mentioned that 11 journalists have been assaulted by police just in short of a month. And this is cases that have been brought before us, including some that have been shot in the head and are in critical conditions. So I find the justification or attempt to really justify police use of violence against journalists to be really, a very low for authorities in Uganda.
Do you think the call for the resignation or firing of the Inspector General of Police is justified? And do you see that happening?
The call is justified because, of course, you cannot have such a person really holding public office. What I know is that with the kind of administration that we have that really wants to violate on human rights at the expense of seeing, them through the election, that they will not really fire or, accept, a resignation from such an officer. But it is really just said that such a person who speaks and justifies impunity should not really be holding such an office.
Will your organization officially file a protest as a result of this announcement by the chief of police, who others say might open the door for police officials or police officers to attack journalists and, for that matter, unarmed citizens?
What we are doing is that at this point is that we are monitoring all human rights violations in the context of elections, and we will be making calls not just particularly on this, but wider calls, and especially to Uganda authorities. They must reverse the persistent use of lethal and excessive force that they are using. Arbitrary arrest, I mean, so many people, including journalists, have been detained, and they have been attacked. The attacks are not just to journalists. You've had attacks against opposition politicians, protesters, human rights defenders, and at this point, we'll definitely be calling that for authorities to ensure that perpetrators are held accountable and that victims are granted access to justice and effective remedies. So we will definitely be looking at all human rights violations that are happening in the context of elections, before elections, during elections, and after elections, and we will be pronouncing ourselves to, what should be done as a result of the human rights violations that we have observed.
Roland Ibole is Amnesty International's Uganda researcher. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A Zambian parliamentarian is expressing concern that the Ministry of Health is unable to account for millions of dollars allocated by the Ministry of Finance for 2019.
Cornelius Mwitwa, a lawmaker from the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says it is a big scandal which should be thoroughly investigated. He adds that those responsible for any financial malfeasance should be prosecuted under the full force of the law. His remarks come after Zambians expressed outrage about reports that officials at the health ministry are unable to account for millions of dollars of funds during a parliamentary session. Local media also reports that officials at the health ministry failed to comply with regulations governing the award of contracts. But supporters of the administration say the allegations are politically motivated to embarrass the government ahead of this year's elections. Parliamentarian Cornelius Mwitwa tells me an independent inquiry will determine those responsible for misappropriating public funds.
In this particular situation, the Ministry of Health has found itself in a bizarre situation where, you know, thousands and millions of dollars, you know, have been found in an equation of suspected abuse, where dubious contracts were signed by the Ministry of Health in multi-million contract supply of medicines and other pharmaceutical, you know, product, for which at tender stage it has now come to the attention of the Public Accounts Committee that tender procedures were not followed in line with the findings of the Auditor General's report, and that those who won the tenders to supply are of questionable legal entity existence. This is what has caused the uproar, and for 2 days now, the Public Accounts Committee has been roasting the controlling officer or permanent secretary of the Ministry of Health to explain under which circumstances such kind of transactions were performed.
What's next in your inquiry? Because I heard you asked pointed questions about a proper investigation to determine what happened to those unaccounted funds. What's next now?
Well, ordinarily, this is a very strange circumstance because the Anti-Corruption Commission and other relevant security agencies, and particularly the Anti-Corruption Commission, has an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with the Office of the Auditor General that at audit stage, wherever the Auditor General's office finds that there are irregularities that require intervention, where there are transactions that make certain entities culpable to face the law, that MOU allows the Anti-Corruption Commission to move in and effect arrests and commence legal, you know, processes before even the report of the Auditor General, you know, comes out. That is what is expected. So that normally it is matters of matters that should arise at the public accounts should normally not be those of criminal nature, and or if they arise at public accounts, matters that are of criminal nature, those involved would already have been booked by the law. In this particular situation, it is strange, but as people have been hearing from the inquiry conducted by the Public Accounts Committee, it would appear that there has been some political heavyweights who were involved in these transactions, and therefore, given the state of the state of governance in this particular country at this particular moment, where you can't guarantee rule of law, supremacy of the law, you find that some political bigwigs who may be or may have been involved will still be at large. But this is a matter that has galvanized national interest. It has been carrying out headlines in mainstream private media in the last 2 days. It is hoped that an action would ensue out of this kind of public outcry. And one would only expect that such action will be instituted by the relevant authorities.
So some people are saying that the UPND is taking advantage of this, which should be handled amicably, to make political capital of this, just to make the government look unpopular and engage in acts of corruption. How do you respond to such criticism?
Well, contrary to such kind of assertions, actually, this is not a matter for which UPND has been found taking advantage of. This is a matter between the Public Accounts Committee of Parliament and the Ministry of Health and its leadership. This is what it is at, and if the UPND make inquiries on the same, they are participating like any other ordinary citizens who are interested to ensure that accountability becomes the hallmark of government public expenditure, and not that the UPND are instigating, orchestrating this kind of debate. You may wish to know that actually this particular committee is a composition of members of parliament across board, and it is chaired by a member who is not from the UPND.
Cornelius Mwitwa is a lawmaker from the Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Thousands of Zimbabweans have been stuck for days at the Bait Bridge crossing on the border with South Africa, and many are blaming government for not doing anything to help ease the congestion at the border. For VOA, Kuzanai Muzengi reports from Bait Bridge.
It's late afternoon in the small Zimbabwean border town of Bait Bridge, but the heat from the sun is still extreme. Wisdom Gapare has thrown civility to the wind and is walking around shirtless, wiping sweat from his face with a drenched towel. Gapare is one of the thousands of people who have been stuck at the Bait Bridge border post for days. Most are Zimbabweans returning to their jobs in South Africa and regional commercial truck drivers. Gapare says the delay forced him to use the little money he had left to buy food while waiting, and he worries about the risk of disease, including COVID-19 infections.
The authorities need to make a plan. We can't go on like this, because now, as much as they're saying that they're trying to prevent the spread of coronavirus, social distancing, all that stuff, there is no social distancing here, number one. And we're facing another threat of cholera because there's no toilets here. Everybody's running to this bush.
Jackie Ngwenya had returned home to Zimbabwe to bury a mother who died last month. Ngwenya, who runs a small catering company in Johannesburg, is frustrated by the prolonged delay at the border. She says most Zimbabweans would rather stay at home instead of going to South Africa.
I thought we would cross easily because they said those who have permits they would cross. But until today, I'm still here by the border. And the other thing is, if our Zimbabwean economy was great, no one would cross going to South Africa because everyone would get their better jobs. But because of the economy that is bad, that's why everyone is crossing to South Africa.
Dr. Norman Matara with the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights urged the government to quickly end the crisis.
This is a potential super spreader of the COVID-19 virus, and it can lead to cases of COVID-19 increasing rapidly in the country. And lastly, we see that there might be a potential outbreak of diarrheal diseases like cholera and typhoid, because we see a lot of people and the ablution facilities at that border post are not adequate.
The Zimbabwe government has said little on the situation. Home Affairs Minister Kazembe Kazembe had promised to respond to questions that VOA sent to him, but he had not done so at the time of going on air. South Africa's Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi recently told journalists the congestion at Bait Bridge was compounded by the unavailability of an automated commercial cargo clearing system on the Zimbabwe side, but the Zimbabwe Revenue Authority rejected this argument. Zimbabwe officials have said much of the delay is because of the requirements for COVID-19 tests to cross the border. A member of the ruling ZANU-PF Central Committee, Joseph Chuma, says the two countries should work together to end the border congestion.
I wish the government of South Africa and the government of Zimbabwe can work out a way to either make it easy for those people to cross over or probably bring them back home, and another solution is found for them.
The Bait Bridge border post is the busiest inland port in Southern Africa. Under normal circumstances, it operates 24 hours and clears about 25,000 people daily, but both Zimbabwe and South Africa have imposed curfews as part of their lockdown measures. Reporting for VOA from Beitbridge on the border with South Africa, I am Kudzanai Msengi.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, supporters of detained former Nigerian presidential candidate Omoyele Sowore have taken their protest to an Abuja court where his case is being heard. Sowore and four other activists were arrested in Abuja on New Year's Eve during a rally for their Revolution Now movement demanding better governance. Authorities have charged them with unlawful assembly and criminal conspiracy. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
About 70 protesters chanted angrily Friday at the Abuja Magistrate Court, demanding that Omoyele Sowore be released immediately. Earlier in the week, the judge presiding over the case postponed her ruling on Sowore's bail application. But police failed to show up with any of the detainees Friday, and court was finally adjourned. Protest leader Kunle Ajayi, who avoided arrest during the raid on New Year's Eve, says the protests will go on.
We are not basing anything on hope. If he doesn't get released, we'll take action. And that's why we are here today. We are not only going to come to court today, we are coming to protest.
Ajayi says the protest on New Year's Eve was largely peaceful until police arrived.
So when they came, instead of even coming to ask us what we were doing or asking any democratic question, if Ashura was in his car, because he didn't join us, he was just filming from his car, and they came and they started attacking us. I was even almost hit with a car.
The five activists, including Sowore, who were picked up that day, have been detained since, with limited access to food, water, and medical care. Authorities call their protest an unlawful assembly, and this week, local media reports the activists have been charged with criminal conspiracy and an attempt to incite public unrest. However, prosecuting lawyer James Idachaba says they have not been formally charged.
It is an FIR. This is not charge. You must know the difference between a charge and an FIR. This false information report.
Sowore ran for the presidency in Nigeria's 2019 elections. His political party, African Action Congress, AAC, did not stand a chance at the polls against the major parties, and he lost. Before his rearrest, Sowore was already facing two felony charges for leading Revolution Now, a political movement made up of mostly younger citizens calling for a better government. His supporters are threatening more protests unless he's freed. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Sudan has officially signed the Abraham Accords, agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. The agreement paves the way for Sudan to relieve its massive debt to the World Bank. For VOA, Nabi Mohedin reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
Thank you.
The historic signing took place at the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum Wednesday. U.S. Treasury Secretary Stephen Mnuchin signed on behalf of Washington, while Sudanese Minister of Justice Nasraddin Abdulbari signed on behalf of Khartoum. Afterward, Abdulbari spoke to reporters. Abdulbari says they welcome the Israeli and neighboring Arab country rapprochement and the diplomatic ties between Sudan and Israel that Sudan will push for its own benefit and for other countries in the region. He said, "We appreciate Mr. Mnuchin's historical visit, and we hope to strengthen ties between Sudan and the U.S. Mnuchin also made a brief statement.
It's a great honor to be here with you today, and I think we'll have a tremendous impact on the people of Israel and the people of Sudan as they continue to work together on cultural and economic opportunities."
The Abraham Accords are a series of U.S. brokered agreements calling for the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and now Sudan to normalize relations with Israel after decades of broken ties. Sudan agreed to sign the accords in part, so the United States would remove the country from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a designation that has blocked Sudan's access to international loans. Late in December, the U.S. removed Sudan from the list and agreed to give Sudan a $1 billion bridge loan to help it clear its debt to the World Bank. Sudanese economist Walid Al-Noor says Sudan needs this help to rebuild an economy struggling with shortages and inflation. Al-Noor says Sudan will benefit from signing the Abraham Accords and the U.S. bridge loan, as it will allow it to enter to the international banking system and relieve the suffering debt. It will also allow Sudan to take a $1.5 billion loan from the World Bank annually. This amount will help in relieving the overwhelmed Sudanese economy. Sudan was put on the U.S. state sponsors of terrorism list for giving refuge to Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders in the 1990s. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
For many during the COVID era, lockdowns, quarantines, and the lack of an active social life have forced them to be alone and to face a deeper part of themselves that is, during normal times, is drowned out by distractions and other people. It's a challenge that hermits and so-called spiritual solitaries have known well from ancient times to today. To get some insight into the difficulties and spiritual satisfactions that near isolation can bring, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Karen Capra-Fredin, a former Catholic nun who has lived for decades on the North Carolina mountainside with her husband, Paul, a former priest. Together, they run Raven's Bread Ministries, a website that supports and informs contemporary hermits and solitaries.
Even as a young girl, Karen Capra-Fredette was deeply drawn to the spiritual life. At the age of 17, she joined the Poor Clares, a Catholic contemplative order, as a nun. But after 30 years there, she concluded that for her, the intense communalism of monastery life prevented the direct and intimate contact with God that she craved.
And I began to realize that if I were to be focused and respond to what was deepest within me, I needed solitude where there was nobody. When there's nobody around, then you're freed from what other people expect of you and free to just live up to what God, the Holy, is calling you to.
Fredette left the monastery to live in solitude in a cabin deep in the West Virginia mountains, an experience that at first felt more like walking in the dark than living in the light. In her 1994 book, Where God Begins to Be, she cites a quote by Patrick Overton that she says continues to sustain her.
When you come to the edge of all the light that you have and you take a step into the darkness, one of two things will happen. Either you will find solid ground beneath your feet or you will be taught to fly. What it means to me is that you walk in absolute trust. You live in the moment, and you begin to realize that, in truth, that's all we do have.
Fredette says she had to learn that lesson of trust during her first days of solitary prayer and meditation in that cabin. She had no safe drinking water or steady income. She was even unsure she would have enough food and firewood to survive the coming winter.
And I remember sitting in my prayer space, and I was totally terrified. And as I sat there, I heard a voice sort of deep within me, which said, well, do you have a roof over your head right now? Well, yes. Do you have enough to eat today? Yes. Do you actually have enough to eat tomorrow? Yes. What more do you need? What you need in the moment will be provided. That's the kind of trust that a hermit has to live with.
Fredette sees a connection between the hermit life and the forced isolation everyday non-hermits are experiencing during the pandemic. She offers this advice for so-called COVID solitaries who want to benefit spiritually from this moment.
You don't have to jump into the pool at the deepest end, but a person who's feeling the need for all kinds of distractions if they deliberately give themselves a sacred space, simple, quiet, for 15 minutes every day, they will find that even that 15 minutes will become so precious that you'll want half an hour. You may want to take an hour, and then you don't need so many words. We have to be patient, but it is a process that will take place almost without our following any special directions. It's a matter of getting in touch with your own self.
Her heart goes out to secular people who are coming to know aspects of themselves that were hidden during more normal, busier times. Indeed, Karen and Paul Fredette's website has been deluged with inquiries since a recent New York Times article about their way of life.
I am in touch with people in fear and people in pain and people angry in the past year. And if they're able, I suggest that we journal. We write down what we are feeling in the present moment. Feelings we need to be in touch with because they do not lie. They're the truth of who we are. And who we are is a very spiritual being.
To find out more about the work Karen Carper and Paul Fredette are doing to support contemporary hermits and those dealing with the spiritual challenges of COVID-era isolation, visit their website at www.ravensbreadministries.com and take it from there. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
See me, I no get 30 billion. Oh no, yeah, yeah. But I got so much love to give you. I got so much love to give you. Oh no, 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 no. I bless the day I found you.
Let's go.
Oh Lord of mercy. Oh, don't see me who I am, yes, yo.
Thank you. Fancy my time spending my life, spending my life, spending my life. When I'm fancy my time. Fancy my time.
My baby, boo, from Chicago.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the tongue cannot claim to be ignorant of what the teeth are doing. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.